You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we talk about pretty much everything. So I want to assign each one of us a theme song. Okay, so I want to go one by one, and we're going to assign the song that you think accurately describes this person's life. You can imagine them walking around, walking in a room, walking up on stage, and this song plays.
Okay.
So let's start. Do we want to start with someone? Or do we? Nico has one for me. It's going to make me cry, I'm sure.
But we can I want to see Brandon cry.
Let's start with Nico. Nico, what do you think my theme song is?
You might hate me for this, and if so, I apologize.
That's the best way to start a sentence. This is going to offend you, but no offense.
This is kind of like no offense. Yeah.
Well, so this might... Well, I don't know. It's hard to tell how thick-skinned Brandon is, because I feel like in a lot of ways he's very thick skin, and in other ways, if you hit the right spot, he's just going to crumble.
He's
just
like a sandcastle, tender little gummy bear.
I have some. So some gummy
a song,
some gummy tenderness.
There is a song that
that's
I
try to say go easy.
I cannot recommend this song. I'm going to name it anyway. I believe the full title is
that's a lot of disclaimers.
I Feel Sexy After Dark.
This is your song for him.
Yes.
So this is what I'm.
I don't know what to do with this. This is the first song that came to mind.
You know that tracks.
When
keep going, Nico. Keep explaining
Nico
yourself.
Thinks of Brandon. That's the song that comes.
When he walks into a room, I can see him holding a boombox playing "I Feel Sexy After Dark."
Oh man. What do you feel there, Brandon?
I'm into that. Yeah.
Have you heard it?
So I'm classic, like, narcissist, like, vain. I can walk in the woods and say, what's up, everybody?
Oh.
That's good. All right.
I think from here, we should just go for other suggestions for Brandon and move around the circle.
Or if there's a, if there's suggestions
or we just call
anybody.
It a wrap and that's it.
Yeah, some of these intros fail, and that's okay. You know, they're all
it's all part of the process.
Have you guys seen One Tree Hill?
Yes.
No.
You know the that basketball opening song, the Gavin DeGraw song, "Wannabe."
What's
the name of it?
I don't wanna be.
Yes.
Baby.
Yeah.
That's the one that comes to mind for you. I don't know
what
why.
Is it?
There's
what?
Like feels,
how does it go? Can you give me the lyrics?
I don't want to be anything other than what I've,
been trying to be lately.
All I have to do is think of that peace of mind.
I'm uncomfortable that this is turning into just Brandon's
Brandon therapy session.
Well, no, we'll go around the circle.
Or we won't. I actually kind of like this. Okay, I don't want to be. Let's see what.
For some reason, this you guys aren't, Nico and Rachel aren't going to know this, but I'm for Kevin, I'm thinking the Doug theme song.
Doug.
I just imagine Kevin be like, hey, hey, hey,
what's this up? Is the hey, guys. This is the second Doug reference I've had this week, by the way. Someone was wearing, you remember Quail Man?
Yeah. He put a belt
someone
on his head. Nico and Rachel are not even. They're barely smiling. They're just like. What?
I am just. I'm amused. I'm amused by the millennials.
Too old. Too
aging men. Millennial things that the Zoomers can't understand.
Remember this, Sean? When, before they had 3D animation.
Oh, Doug. That I don't know what to do with that. He was a classic, so I'll take it in stride. He was also kind of a doofus.
You have. Well, you don't have the doofus vibes. You don't have the doofus vibe, but you have Doug energy.
I feel like these should all be taken as like relatively complimentary.
Doug energy.
Yeah.
So hear me out, for Kevin. The first thing
it's only up from here, I think.
Was Bare Necessities?
Oh yeah!
Like,
oh my
god! Like you like walk around. Sometimes you throw things.
Yeah, yeah.
Not aggressively, just
with all the bare.
Yeah. There's like a tenderness.
If you prick a raw paw.
Or well, a prickly pear.
Like a goofiness. Bear necessities.
Sometimes beware.
Oh, dude, bear necessities is a great one for you, Kev. Yeah, all right. Blue.
You got the I'll take walk Blue. Sometimes.
Blue kind of has the same vibe as Doug.
Oh.
Yeah, but like Doug's big brother, I guess.
If I Googled similar. Doug, would it pop up with what you're talking
you're
about?
You're probably going to need more context than just Doug.
Yeah, it's just a basic cartoon. Yeah. Did you ever, by the way, this is another character in Doug. Did you ever think Patty Mayonnaise sounded like an old woman? They're supposed to be like young teenagers, and she's like, well, Doug, we should go out on a date. And you're like, is she 80?
Maybe she just started mayonnaise? Smoking.
That's some great Doug knowledge. Like right off the tip of your tongue.
Have you watched Doug recently, or is this just
No, it's just I love Nickelodeon.
It was a like classic for millennials. Yeah.
Okay. Look at that sweater vest.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's big.
I think that's you have better sweater hair, energy. Kevin.
I got better hair, though. That's good, because he's got like the one little twig.
Oh, man.
I'm feeling like Rachel is. I'm getting Tangled vibes. I'm trying to find the right song from Tangled.
Okay.
Maybe like When Will My Life Begin?
Na, 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 Saturday morning, I shouldn't write an autobiography then. There'd be nothing.
Well, I'm alive. That's my biography.
What's the one where they're in the when they first run away in Tangled?
I have a dream.
Yes.
I have a dream.
I feel like that one.
She just wants to see the floating lanterns.
Just wants to. Yeah. See, I like that. I think that When Will My Life Begin? That feels patronizing to me. I like I Have a Dream better for her. Gosh, Tangled's so good. I love that movie.
I know.
Ugh. That's good.
Adley was Rapunzel for like 5 Halloweens in a row. Because she had red hair too. She like loved
when Rapunzel like is reunited with her parents and they just hug her and like kneel down, I just lose it every time.
Yeah. Nico wouldn't know because apparently he doesn't like Disney or feeling things. Yeah. So
I was just thinking about how much Disney has like infiltrated the lives of American families. It's tragic.
It's tragic.
Yeah.
Not giving actually. Language to emotions. I hate when people do that.
I hate when they make you
emotions
feel.
Emotions don't need a language. They need to be not felt.
Yeah.
They need to, there's the if healthy
we could
response.
Just, if we could just repress them. Okay, we have to have a song for Nico.
No, you don't.
Well, that's with that, I went to like Paint It Black or something, but Nico, like his soul, because he doesn't like to feel emotions.
Black Hole Sun.
I was being hyperbolic. Black Hole Sun is a fantastic song.
Is there a song about like being empty inside?
Ooh.
Certainly something from the 90s.
If there was,
that vibe.
If there was, I feel like I would know about
inside,
it.
I could swallow my doubt, turn it inside out, find nothing and faith in nothing. Want to put my tender heart in a blender.
Oh, I just been around to a beautiful oblivion.
I don't think that
rendezvous
really
that. Rendezvous.
How do you feel about Green Day?
Oh, Green Day.
I never really listened to them. I heard them a little bit because a friend of mine got into punk rock, and that was about the extent of it.
I'm that's a great poll, Rachel, and I would have never put Green Day and Rachel together. That was a good poll that you know Rachel. What that the other way that you know Green Day that Rachel
I just
Green
really
Day.
Liked songs that helped me get in my feels.
Okay.
Green what's Day the, gets what's you the Green feels? Day one? Hope you have the time of your life.
Every graduation song for every millennial.
Boulevard of Broken Dreams.
Boulevard of Broken Dreams. That wasn't Green Day, was it?
Yeah, it was.
How does
I
that go?
I walk a lonely road.
Oh, yeah.
The only one that I have ever known.
That's a good one.
I didn't have friends in middle school.
Yeah.
Just kidding. Well, not really.
Do you think people...
I saw Green Day live once at the Warped Tour.
Do you think people will have turned this off by now?
Hopefully.
No.
Because it's like...
It would be better if they did,
yeah. We've descended into a different realm.
Nico gives me war movie vibes.
War movie vibes.
Yeah, like there's like an intensity,
like Spielberg?
But there's still like a good... I don't know.
Actually, like, because of his affiliation with Goose...
Beach scene on Saving Private Ryan?
Yeah.
By affiliation, I mean you look like Goose.
Yeah.
I think if the Top Gun song played when Nico walked in the room, everyone would
Danger
be all about it. It'd just be like, yeah.
Yeah.
You always look the part, dressed to the nines.
Yeah.
It's Kenny Loggins,
the
right?
Stash.
It is. It's
I feel
Kenny
like he's
Loggins.
Got Kenny Loggins vibes. Feels like the right.
That's all good.
Right. Well, right before I move on, I want to re-echo it because I kept thinking about it. My pick for Kevin is very brazen.
Ooh, okay.
We're talking.
I'm a little nervous after what you did with Brandon.
No, it's not. It's a completely different different.
That doesn't come to mind here. When you think of me.
Not quite. We're talking any piece for the organ written by Johann Sebastian Bach.
Oh,
it has to be big, bold, aggressive, probably in a minor key. Just like
and loving?
Kevin has entered. Loving too, Kevin Nico? Has entered the room.
You know, Nico,
that sounds
I'm
like the Imperial March. That sounds.
I know, I was just thinking that.
The I'm Imperial embrace March, that, but Nico? With a Baroque aesthetic,
and
gonna,
hopefully I'm enjoy.
I'm gonna go with you, Nico, but I'm gonna change the instrumentation to what's the little dulcimer? What's the instrument with Baroque? Bing. Harpsichord.
Oh my,
the
gosh.
Harpsichord.
Ding 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 ding. Very like Renaissance.
Be like,
guys.
Well, actually.
Kevin
and then he'll
has
just say all of the big
like
words,
pointed
like,
well, toes, and
pedantically speaking, I think
the root word is actually
and the warp and the woof. If you consider, bing 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 bing.
Bing, 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 bing. I was also waiting for that to come up. I was shocked it hadn't yet. I'm not even kidding. Right. By the way, it's also the second time I've heard the harpsichord reference this week. It's like
wow.
So yeah. Random.
Do you feel known?
I feel like
we're
exposed.
On brand. We're on brand. Nico, here's the thing about that. I'm so glad that you feel like you have the freedom.
Hey, there it is.
To talk about that.
Oh, absolutely.
You know? I mean,
segue now.
Freedom is such a good thing that we have.
It is. When we don't abuse it.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Kevin, how would you...
What is freedom?
Some would say.
How would you describe freedom in context of...
I'm going to need a better switch.
If you were going to compare William Wallace's freedom to the freedom that Paul talks about.
Well, Paul's freedom wasn't played by Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
So there's that.
The it's the biggest difference. It's the biggest difference. I'm not going to...
Oh, okay. I tried really hard.
You did.
For real.
To no avail.
You started the message talking about the concept of freedom, and you said something that I thought was interesting, that true freedom is the ability to say no. And I really do. I am curious how you would compare that to like our sort of quintessential Western view of freedom.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to turn it into a question, actually, and have you guys riff on that.
Do it.
It'd be interesting to hear, like, when you guys think of freedom, what comes to mind? And obviously, you know, you guys already listened to me talk about this on Sunday, and so it's colored with that kind of veneer. But, like, when you guys think, like, how does the world view freedom? Like, how would you guys envision, if you were to ask a random person on the street, what is freedom? Would they make the case that I did, that freedom in the modern world is essentially the ability to say yes to whatever you want?
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. no one can impose mm-hmm. a difference mm-hmm. on that. Like, where do you guys see that play out? Maybe that's a better...
Live your life as you see fit.
Mm.
Live your life. Don't... The maybe the one boundary that they would put on it is don't hurt anybody in the process.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Which I actually don't think they mean, but for the sake
it
of...
It sounds good.
Yeah.
I think they mean it. I actually do think they mean it. I just don't think they... I don't think we understand how to, when we play that logic out, that it doesn't work. Because what if, again, my freedom causes harm to others? That's where, like, but their freedom causes harm to me. Like, because we don't have a common understanding of what morality is or a common story of that, we can't actually differentiate between freedom and harm or good and harm because we don't have a shared definition of it. I don't know if that makes sense, but...
I guess I say aspirational because... There are certain people that they're okay with it hurting. If it's the right, basically, I think they would, if it was more accurate, they would say, don't hurt the wrong people.
Yeah. I don't know
if I'm making any sense, but.
Yeah. No, I think you are. I think it's again, getting down to what's confessed versus what's lived, right? And they'll kind of communicate freedom in that way, but they don't, when they play the logic out, it doesn't make sense. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. When you actually play that out, like something like, or I would even say something like consent. Is maybe the strong, which is again is a good thing, but that's about as solid as we can get in the modern world without a shared story of right and wrong as to what holds it together. And to me, it's such a flimsy ethical kind of foundation, right? And again, this isn't me saying consent's bad by any stretch, but I'm just saying it's no way to build a whole ethical framework, right? You can't just build it off something like that, but instead you place that within a larger ethical kind of understanding of the world. And then it makes sense, right? And so freedom, what I was trying to do, you know, when Paul in the Galatians text begins with, you were born to be free, and then the first thing he says is, do not, that strikes our modern ears in kind of a weird way, because we don't think of freedom as being something not to do. We always think of it in the positive of do whatever you want, do whatever you feel, do what, you know, and if anything constricts that, then cast that away so that you don't have to essentially have that impinged upon your freedom. Mm-hmm. But the New Testament understanding of freedom, particularly Paul here in Galatians 5, is exactly the opposite. He says freedom's actually the ability to say no to some things. And what he's getting at is this idea that we can be enslaved to our desires, to our distorted loves, our distorted kind of flesh is the phrase he uses for it, which we'll get to in a second. But it's in the ability to say no is where you actually find freedom, right? And like, I know, Brandon, a little while back, we had a conversation around like limitations actually set us free. Like, we don't think of it in that way, but I think you used the example when we were talking about that, like an artist needs boundaries mm-hmm. to be free in their creativity. Like a painting naturally has boundaries because you're blocked in by the canvas. Like the canvas is only so big. Or in music, there are certain confines and limitations playing in a particular key or a particular time signature that actually allows the flourishing to take place. Mm-hmm. The same is true when we think of freedom just in human flourishing, right? Like there are in fact boundaries in which we can flourish. But the modern view says, no, you can just do whatever you want. And again, there's some of those like hints of it with consent, or as we were talking about earlier, or do no harm. But there isn't really a strong sense of what the boundaries are. And so Paul is saying, in your freedom, do not do certain things. And that's actually how you'll flourish.
I'm paying for school, so I feel the need to interject biology into every conversation I come into. You mentioned music and art, mm-hmm. art in general, I guess,
yeah.
as like having confines that allow them to be free. The human body is the same way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you cannot apply, do whatever you want, whenever you want in any capacity to, any natural process really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the reason we don't like to listen to music that's in random time signatures and doesn't stick to a basic principle, a foundation, mm-hmm. is because it quite literally messes with our body's perception mm-hmm. of the air moving into our ears.
Mm-hmm.
It's this interconnectedness of boundaries that help create a network for freedom, ironically enough.
Yeah.
And that extends down to the cellular level even.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, again, I think a play at trying to be something we're not.
Mm-hmm.
And if we layer theology onto that conversation, right, we think that you know, God is that which doesn't have limitation. Mm-hmm. And so when you think through the lens of that, like when we are trying to transcend our limitations, we can't actually, like we're trying to be God, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Which is beyond what we can. Like we are bound by time, by space. God is not. And so in like part of why we feel that rub is we're, again, doing something we were never intended to do.
Mm-hmm.
The other example I think we talked about, it'd be like if we all decided, hey, we're going to go play soccer. But then I started playing basketball, trying to play soccer. Like it's not like it just conflicts, right? It mm-hmm. just doesn't make sense. It's not logical.
Mm-hmm.
And so often I think in our views of freedom, we think of it in those terms of like, I can just do whatever I want, but it isn't coherent to what it means to be human. And so you instantly are kind of falling into a trap of trying to do something you weren't created for. And so our freedom actually becomes the thing that enslaves us, mm-hmm. Right? And that's Paul's point. He's saying, if your freedom is do whatever you want, the assumption is you know what you should do and that you can control what you can do. But that's Paul's point, is we actually can't do that. We have a way over extended view of who we are and our ability and the way we interact in the world to actually say no to certain things.
Mm.
And so Paul's whole thing on freedom is, again, how do we say no to the things that we need to say no to? And in the same way, that's saying yes to the right things. You know what I mean? Like that is actually a good, healthy kind of boundary.
I'm thinking two things. One, I would love to see like a YouTube series on you going to like a basketball game, but playing soccer.
Just run up and start slide tackling people and just kicking the ball.
Just see how long it takes you to kick them to kick you off the court.
Or like the other example I've used, by the way, which I think may be better than that one, is it'd be like trying to like use a bike as a canoe, right? Mm-hmm. In the sense of like, if I hop on a bike, jump in water and start pedaling, I probably will, in fact, go somewhere. Like, in some ways, that mode of transportation will move me along.
You'll go straight down.
Yeah, I'll probably go straight down. But it would, in fact, like, in some ways, move forward. But it's clearly not what a bike is designed for, right? And so then it gets into this idea of, okay, what was the human created for? And when you begin to live into that reality, you actually begin to flourish because you're doing what you were created for. But so much, again, of our particular area in the Bay Area, I mean, that's the kind of technological innovative impulse that is this area, is about how do we transcend those things. You know, I think I mentioned this in a meeting yesterday, but there's an article in Time Magazine that some tech guru in this area is trying to, he's convinced that he won't die. And he says that's a problem that we can technologically solve. Like, to me, that's such a good, like, you know, kind of microcosm of that modern world, is that we believe we can actually transcend being human.
The Bay Area
and
is
think
where,
that's flourishing.
The Bay Area is where we would build a bike that can act as a canoe.
Yeah.
Or try to, at least.
Exactly.
Well, and there's, isn't that how paddle boats behind it were invented?
That's fair.
That's true.
That's what you get when you mix a paddle boat and a bike.
The other thing I was thinking was, you know, we tend to, when we hear you can't do this or don't do this, we tend to hear it as, you know, obviously like a negative. But what you're kind of talking about a little bit is almost like we need to consider the opportunity cost of not living the way that we were designed to flourish. Like, it's not just that it's like we could focus on the thing that we're not supposed to do. Mm-hmm. AKA in your example, we're not supposed to ride our bike in the river.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we could be like, man, you mean you're saying I can't ride my bike in the river? Or we could say, but also if you're riding your bike in the river, you're missing out on what it's like to ride a bike.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And like, I feel like we don't focus on that because we keep thinking about what we can't do. And it's like, look, I've designed you to just follow my schematic.
Yeah. And that was, I think in both services, I mentioned C.S. Lewis's little thing on In the Way to Glory. He opens with that idea again. We've been offered a life at sea where we have all this adventure, all this joy available to us, but we actually are more content sitting on the beach playing with mud pies. And his whole thing is, it's the problem isn't desire, it's that you don't desire enough. Mm. And it's like we get caught in thinking it's fun to try to ride our bike in the river, opposed to saying there's something better. You could actually ride your bike where it's supposed to and flourish. Mm. And so we have a tendency, I think particularly when we talk about this idea of freedom, to view all desire as bad. But that's, to me, that's a radical misread of what God is doing with even giving us desires, right? Ultimately, those are instilled in us for a good, healthy thing. But they get caught up and they get distorted by both, again, sins we commit, sins committed against us, sins committed around us. All of those things distort desire. But desire is not the problem, right? Like, it's a good, healthy thing. It's we have to aim that desire and kind of understand its role and how it's supposed to flourish. Which, again, that's where Paul is really bringing this distinction between you can be governed by the flesh or you can be governed by the spirit. Hmm. And you're going to be governed by something, right? Something is going to drive you and kind of help aim your desire. Which one will you allow to kind of take control, if you will?
So you talked about, so he says, you know, you're not supposed to live according to the flesh. Mm-hmm. And you talked about the word sarx.
Yeah.
And I think you said something really important that I'm hoping that you would reiterate a little bit in mm-hmm. regards to that, and that is that it's not necessarily talking about the body when he's talking about the flesh. And talk about why that's kind of an important distinction to make.
It's important because there's a long-ish tradition in the Christian world that has diminished the body. And I think it's connected again to this idea of desire, and certainly Paul's teaching here on the idea of the flesh. When we equate the flesh with the body, we obviously see Paul's very down on what he calls the flesh, but not down on the body. And when we make that distinction, what happens is the body or the material world becomes superfluous, right? It's not important. It's an obstacle to overcome. It's something that's in the way of the real thing. or again, with this idea of the body, that, you know, we have this image of the body just being a vehicle to carry around the self, right? Which is, and this is rooted in a much longer tradition as to where the self moved inward and we begin to diminish the body. But what I think is downstream from this is that when we diminish the value of physicality or material or the body, is that that's the underpinning behind something like racism, where bodies all of a sudden don't matter. Because, you know, and this is kind of, I don't know if I want to say classic, but when I'm thinking of like the antebellum South in our own country's history, some of the teachings out of the church where at least they're getting exposed to the gospel, and yet it was to enslave their bodies. And like all of us now see that and think, I mean, how heinous is that understanding of the person? But you could see where the logic is, where if the bodies don't matter and the spirit is all that matters, well, at least they're getting saved or whatnot. But that would be just, to me, entirely antithetical to what the New Testament's teaching about the human. And so when bodies don't matter and only the spirit or soul matters, that to me is the damaging consequences of poor theology, where you can get into a place where you justify something as heinous as our country's past with slavery and kind of allow that to be an okay justified thing, right? Because in theory, the logic is the ends justify the means. But once you begin to recognize the New Testament teaching that we as humans, our body and spirit, all of that comes together to create a soul, therefore bodies matter. And then you, it's logically impossible to divorce those things, right? Because then you recognize, no, part of that human is in fact their physical existence, their spiritual existence, like all of that is wrapped up into one. And so we can't separate those two distinctions. And that's why even when Paul's talking here, using this word sarx, I'd want to verify this, so I'm thinking a little off the cuff. I don't think he ever uses sarx in a positive way in the New Testament. So in kind of his theology, he's using it to speak about the sinful human nature. So the distorted part of us that is bent away from God, it can be translated body, but it isn't in the way we think of body. When Paul wants to talk about our physical body, he uses this Greek word soma, which is where he talks about both the physical body and the metaphoric body of Christ when he's talking about the church. So those are kind of, I think, the two distinctions. And then maybe the last note on this is this separation where the body is bad or the material's bad and the spirit's good. That's actually, I mean, that has its roots in Plato. It doesn't have its roots in Jesus. And
the philosopher?
Or yeah, the philosopher, not in the texture.
Or
not the toy?
The toy.
Okay.
But it was also, it's heresy. It's Gnosticism, which if you're familiar with kind of church tradition, you'll recognize that as heresy. So
I'm not familiar with it.
Okay. It essentially is just that spirit good, material bad. So therefore nothing physical matters. Divorce is again, Galatians, the church's history has been.
You can discount what happens to the body because it's the worst part of being human.
Or any material thing, even beyond that.
So I guess sarx and soma are two different words, but they're not synonyms in the way that we nowadays will use flesh and body almost interchangeably.
Correct. With, again, the one caveat, and we're getting pretty nerdy here, is, again, sarx can be translated body. And so you encounter it in certain places where it is referenced as body. But in Paul's use of the word, he doesn't mean it physical body. Again, this is where I'd want to verify, but I think almost every time, if not every time, he uses the word sarx, he's speaking of the sinful human nature. But if you were to look in kind of extra biblical texts in the Greek world, ancient Greek world, it could be used as a physical body, yeah. But he uses it in a unique way. And now we're like deep in the weeds. but I just want to make, like, you will encounter that word and it be body, but it's not what Paul intends.
So if we live life according to the flesh, and you pack this out in Romans a little bit, we can actually kind of be enslaved to our flesh. And Paul talks a little bit about that. Yeah. And you talked about sort of this framework about how our minds can be governed by the world. And I thought that was really interesting. Could you talk through those things?
Yeah. So Romans 8, Paul talks about, again, that distinction. Again, the flesh and the spirit are so key to him. And so he talks about what does it mean to be governed by the flesh versus governed by the spirit. And in that text, Paul just says point blank, the mind governed by the flesh is death. The mind governed by the spirit is life and peace. So when he's talking about those two realities, he's saying that's essentially the trajectory of if we allow the flesh, the sinful human nature, to direct our lives. If in our freedom we indulge the flesh, right, which is what Paul says not to do, in Romans 8, he says that will lead to death. That's the result of it. Or again, in another place in Romans, we're more familiar with, the wages of sin is death. What sin gets is a life ruled, like a life ruled by the flesh is ruled by sin, and sin earns death. Like it's the natural trajectory of sin and brokenness. It's where your life will naturally go. So this concept though, of like, how then do we become enslaved to sin? And this is, I've taken this from John Mark Comer's book, Live No Lies. And he has this great little framework he uses to talk about the three classic enemies of the spiritual life. And this is like, these three enemies are historic church teaching on what are the enemies of the spiritual life: the world, the flesh, and the devil. And you'll see those kind of all throughout church history of kind of the common, biggest three enemies. And so each of these kind of have a role in how we become enslaved to the flesh. And so the first is, again, this idea of deceptive ideas, which is really in the Renewing the Mind series. We've talked a little bit about that. This is from the devil, right? Again, who's the father of lies. Deception is his native tongue, like all these kind of teaching on Jesus. He distorts a certain idea. And again, the classic one is in Genesis. Did God really say you can't eat from this tree? Right? It's a little bit of a, like, hints of truth, but yet it's a distortion of what God's actually said. Because like when we talk about deceptive ideas, we're not talking about just random lies of like E does not equal MC squared. You know, like it's not like a random thing, but it's rather it plays on this little tiny bit of truth, but yet it's a deception. It's a lie. And so Comer says like deceptive ideas will then play to, so that's the devil's role, deceptive ideas, play to our disordered loves, which is the flesh, right? And so this idea of disordered loves are it takes a good, healthy desire, if we're going to keep using that phrase, and it places it in the improper ordering. Mm-hmm. So I give a few examples of that. One of the examples I think is maybe more appropriate is when we think of like the way that people can idolize or try to live vicariously through their kids. Mm-hmm. That's a disordered love in which they're placing the weight of their identity on their kid. But their kid was never meant to bear that weight. It's a healthy thing to love your kid and want the best for your kid, but it can't be the ultimate thing of your life or else you'll crush that kid. So when these loves then are disordered or out of place, again, that's where our flesh, what we desire, comes into play, and that can then enslave us. So again, in that example, when your kid becomes the source of your identity, it is a good love, a good desire, that's distorted, though. It's disordered. It's not in the way in which it should properly fall. And so that then plays. So you can see the link between deceptive ideas, something like, your kid should be the best thing ever, right? Like there's an inherent truth in that. There's a little bit of like, yeah, we want the best for our kids. It's kind of a distortion. Like ultimately the world doesn't hinge on your child, though. That plays to a disordered love in which I say I've got to, like, my identity is wrapped up in my child. That then the third step, so that's deceptive ideas, the devil, disordered loves is the flesh, plays to this third enemy that are where that then gets normalized in society. And that third enemy is the world, which again is think of it more as we're not at war with the physical world, but rather, again, that sort of the phrase I use that everyone makes fun of me for, the zeitgeist of the day, the spirit of the age. That's what is what Paul's saying when he talks about the world. And so what happens then is that gets normalized in society. So think about like in our society to play out the logic of this particular instance.
Helicopter
abuser.
Parents.
Helicopter parents. I would place it a little more even just on the sort of youth obsessed world we live in. Mm. That like the normalization is that young is better than old.
Mm.
Right. Which is again, historically radically new. The way that we emphasize youth over actually, in most cultures before ours, the elderly were esteemed.
And not most the youth, cultures outside of the U.S. even will
still esteem the elderly. Yeah.
I kind of feel that.
And so you see the way that's normalized.
That side of the room, actually, yeah. From the youngins.
From the youngins over there.
Like they look down on us.
Yeah. Because of my gray beard.
I was going to say that I absolutely think that youth are relatively stupid, but since you brought it up, get God, old man.
Yeah. So you see the way then that normalization, in society is I think that's part of the reason it begins to enslave us, is we assume, because of the way society views that deceptive idea, that disordered love, that it's a good, healthy thing. Of course, you love your child. Shouldn't you push them to be the best they possibly could? Right? And so that normalization then becomes the way that you get caught in these sort of cycles. Mm. So that kind of framework is how I think we become governed, quote, by the flesh.
And we can see, and we probably all have experienced living into the stories that society has normalized.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I mean, that's people kind of getting disenfranchised with the American dream, right? Mm-hmm. Like, wait a second. Mm. If like the story that everybody has said is, if I make a lot of money or make enough money and then buy a house,
yeah,
and have a family,
that's the good life,
that I'm going to be happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And why am I so miserable right now?
Yeah.
And then so then you go and buy a Corvette.
Yeah. And that, again, that deceptive idea plays on a disordered love that says, like, security, luxury, that's what's successful, which, again, isn't inherently like a wrong thing to want to have a secure home, and like that's a good, healthy thing. But when it's placed as the source of your identity, that's then normalized in society, all of it becomes a sort of taken for grantedness. Like, it's just what we assume life is about, and that's built on a different footing than what the Spirit would have us lead in Paul's framework, right? And so that then becomes that sort of normalization, becomes that enslavement. And again, the idea is if we believe lies long enough, we begin to live them, and that's Comer's point in the book, is these lies then become the water we swim in, the air we breathe, whatever metaphor we're going to use. And that then is how we're enslaved to our flesh. And it happens, I think the key here is it happens so subtly. It doesn't happen in like, we tend to think, particularly in the church world, that I'll see the demon's got the, you know, he's got horns on his head, he's hiding behind the bush, like, I'll see him. But no, he's way more smart than that. It's deceptive. It's subtle. It's kind of through the side door. And we have to have a vision for that.
And it happens from so many different angles and layers. It's not just society starting to esteem the young.
Yeah.
It's not just like an overemphasis on X, Y, or Z. Mm-hmm. This happens throughout various points of every single person's life.
Yeah.
All super subtle. And by the time you realize where all those different points of failure are, it's super late.
Yeah. 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 Because it's, again, and this is where we get back to the way we're formed is through practices and habits. And the world kind of reifies these things through habits and practices. And every advertisement you see subtly kind of communicates that youth is better than age, and all these kind of little deceptions, they're played out in a thousand different ways where you are an embodied person walking through the world, and those habits then form you. And so to counterform those, we have to have an alternate, not only just understanding of the world, you don't just need to reverse your deceptive ideas, you have to reverse your disordered loves, which loves are shaped not just through thinking, right? Like, I love Lindsay more now than when we got married, not because I think more of her, but because we've taken our licks. We've gone through some things. It's been difficult. It's been hard. I've learned at times I don't feel like loving her, but yet love is still a choice I should make. And like all those things, that kind of robust understanding of shaping a love, like we think of it as just, if I process the right information, I'll love something. But in the same way that disordered love is shaped, how we fix that love has to be more than just through thinking. Which even in Paul's imagery, right, because that's his anecdote to this, is he says, instead, walk by the Spirit. Not think about the Spirit, not just have the right theology of the Spirit. All of that does play a role, but I love the imagery of walking, or later he'll say, keep in step with the Spirit. It's active. That's embodied language. It's not just do a really good Bible study on the Spirit. That'll be essential, and we'll need that part of it too, because thinking and truth play a role. But to actually transform and shape your love, it has to move beyond just mere idea or information transfer. And that's how we begin to reorder the heart and the love that we have. That's how we counteract it.
So we, you know, I was just trying to find a framework a little bit in my head. Like, there have to be like larger archetypes of ways that this shows up in our lives as humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started thinking, wait a second, the whole reason we're talking about this is because we're in a series, and we've actually chosen based on a lot of different information, some to focus on, some mm-hmm. common deceptive ideas,
yeah.
and some biblical, you know, remedies or antidotes, as
yeah.
you say,
yeah.
to counteract some of those.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe from that vantage point, real quick, give us a quick overview.
Yeah.
What are we going to start trying to practice together? What have we practiced together? Yeah, and yeah. what is the deceptive idea behind it?
Yeah. 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 Because again, all formation is counterformation, right? I've said that a lot. We've said that a lot. And this is exactly why, because again, there are habits or practices of the world that we're counterforming against. Mm-hmm. So we just spent a year working on the practice of attentiveness. And again, we're very precise in our language on why we practice that. And so we've used that we practice attentiveness to God in contrast to a world of distraction and hurry, right? And so we're kind of earmarking that there are practices of the world that lead to distraction and hurry. And those subtle deceptive lies are that busy people are important people mm-hmm. and good people, right? Like that's a little tiny lie that says hurry is a better quality of life. And so that hurriness, though, as we're saying, prevents us from being attentive to God, right? There is a sense in which God is in the quiet. He's in the mundane. Like, he's in the big, too. He's like, he's all of that. But we race at such a pace where we're never actually attentive to God. And so in that, we're trying to counter the practices of the world that are taken for granted, particularly in the Bay Area. We just assume you got to get on the treadmill and go and run and go hard and go fast, get on the hamster wheel, all that to just try to earn an existence, right? And so that slowly teaches us that that's the good life. Mm-hmm. So we counter that with something like silence, solitude, and Sabbath, which again, I think last week on the podcast, we talked about this a little bit, but those two habits are really dealing with how you spend time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
To be silent and to be alone, you just have to unplug from the thing. Like, you can't do that in a hurried way.
Mm.
Sabbath obviously is saying re-architect your whole week around taking a day to disconnect from the machine where you're not producing anything. You're just existing and being in communion with God. Like, those are really just looking at how do we create a frame of time or a relationship to time that allows for you to connect with the Holy Spirit. Then that's where we get to renewing the mind, which is what, again, we're in the season of launching now, which we practice renewing the mind in contrast to a world of noise, competing narratives, and addictions, right? And this is the idea of, particularly that idea of like competing narratives, is there are stories racing through our head of the good life. This is similar, again, to the attentiveness, that are communicating deception, you know, kind of, again, lies that we are living out. And so how do we then unlearn those things? That's where two ways you can, and none of these are like in total. We believe there's probably a bunch of ways to be attentive and renewing the mind and all those sorts of things. But the two that we're kind of earmarking is, again, fasting as a way of curating your mind, meaning you intentionally kind of put yourself in a position where you have to focus on God. When you feel hunger, you become laser focused on one thing. That then ironically allows all the other things to come to the surface. And you realize, oh, I've been living with a narrative that I have to satisfy every strong desire I feel. And that all of a sudden comes to the surface. And you're like, oh, I didn't realize how driven I was by pleasure, by, you know, eating a muffin or a donut or whatever. And that thing is controlling me. And like, oh, I'm driven by satiating that strong desire. But you can, in fact, say no to those things, right? So fasting is a way in which we're trying to put ourselves into a position of dependence on God. Where we clear our minds in a way where we're feasting on the Holy Spirit, but also starving the flesh. I mean, that was the big idea from this past Sunday, is in that kind of mode, we're allowing the Spirit to bring up all these narratives and competing ideologies that are controlling our life. And then the counter, which we'll get to in the spring, is we have to fill our mind. And so we fill our mind with Scripture. Opposed to filling our minds with these particular lies, we fill our minds with the gospel, with the life of Jesus, with the teachings of Jesus. All these things begin to kind of marinate and saturate in our minds. And again, sometimes we can make this more complicated, but like the simple logic is, right, like if you fill your mind, like take whatever, and again, I'm not down on watching TV. I watch TV most days. But if we meditate or sit with, fill our imaginations with whatever we see on Netflix, whether it's
the violence, the vengeance, the, I mean, whatever story arc
or Doug
you want to play out, or Doug. Doug's pretty wholesome. That might lead to goodness. But if you fill it with that, like, are we at all surprised when that then comes out of our life? Mm. When we're filled with watching, you know, whatever anger just explode on people over and over, and that becomes the character you're watching on TV. Like, are we really surprised that we become more in that direction? Mm. Like, in some ways, it's a pretty simple logic, right? Take those narratives out, replace it with something that leads, what Paul would say, the Spirit. Walk with the Spirit. And then love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, and self-control slowly begins to actually kind of terraform our souls, where that then becomes who we are and what comes out of our life.
And I have
terraform
watched...
Terraform our souls. That's fantastic.
That's a good phrase, isn't it?
That is fantastic.
I have watched so much Walker, Texas Ranger... that I now...
You just roundhouse kick the devil.
I roundhouse kick everything I can.
I don't know if they know that reference.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Excellent.
So I think one thing you said that I think we all need to know going into this, because there is some skepticism around fasting. I feel like if you've been around the Christian world for a while...
Yeah.
There's a few things that stick out... as we have, like, just in general, that I've talked to, like, a lot of different Christians that they remember. One is, and I think you're going to talk about this in the coming weeks in the series, but one is this idea that we're doing it together, which is sort of counter to what we've always, a lot of Christians think about when they think, they think about the verse and when Jesus is talking about, you know, don't let anybody know when you're fasting kind of thing, or do it in secret. So I'm curious, some of the objections maybe that we've heard, but the other thing I think that maybe I want to end on here that I think is really important to remember is that when you're doing this, you're actually picking a fight with the thing that enslaves you. Theoretically, if you're doing it right, it's going to bring to surface the very thing that's enslaving you.
Yeah.
And to know that that's going to be, I mean, it's going to be,
it's going to be hard.
It's not going to be an easy thing. So what would you have to help us
think
through those objections and to fight through that?
Yeah, the first objection, you know, Jesus text in Matthew 6, we're actually, that's what we're preaching on this week. So in some ways, I'd say just kind of wait, let us develop this theme over the 4 weeks we're preaching about it. And so you'll see that unpack a little bit. But in short, Matthew 6, Jesus doesn't necessarily say, don't let people know you're fasting. That's not the word. Nor does he say, do it in secret. He says, you know, essentially cover up if you're looking drab and you're looking down. And he's talking in that text about motivation. I actually think he's talking about essentially virtue signaling. Because he's talking about right before that, he's talking about prayer. And he says, don't pray on the street corner to be seen by others. But he isn't, you know, like none of us would say that we shouldn't pray publicly. I mean, if so, again, as church leaders, we're in sin every week when we pray in front of a crowd, right? And the same thing is, I think, playing out with fasting. He's not saying don't fast and allow others to know it. He's saying do it for the right motivation. Mm. If you're fasting to be seen by others, to appear holy, then you've missed the mark. And so he's much more worried. I think that is a teaching, and we'll unpack this on Sunday, a teaching about motivation, not about actually how you play out your fasting. And then also, I think, and again, I'll talk about this on Sunday. I mean, fasting is, it's wild how strong of a tradition this had until the modern church. I mean, it is just, it was part and parcel to following Jesus. The more I dig into it, the more I research it. It's like, it just was a common practice, which is, again, Jesus in Matthew 6, when he says, when you fast, not if you fast, but when you fast. So that would be my first response to that objection. And then to the second of like, did I already speak? What was the second one?
Picking a fight with something.
Yeah. Picking the fight with your flesh. Yeah. It's gonna be hard, but I think that's also the intention. You know, with the caveat again of, I think there are genuine health concerns, consult a doctor to ensure that it's a proper thing, as well as mental health concerns. Like, again, just mention this a lot because I know it's a sensitive topic, but if you've had an unhealthy relationship with food or your body, I think those are appropriate reasons to take a step. Maybe for you, fasting isn't withdrawing, you know, abstaining from food, but taking a step towards healing those kind of, again, those deceptions, those brokenness in your story. And again, we'll talk Sunday a little bit more about that. But I would just say that it is supposed to be hard. You know, I was talking to a couple people out in the courtyard who were like, man, I have a visceral reaction to it. I don't know if I can do it because I get so angry when I'm hungry. And I didn't quite say this to them then, but in some ways, that's kind of the point, is that's actually revealing something within you. Like when I, again, as I think a couple weeks ago I talked about on stage, when I fast, I tend to get very impatient. And I think the Lord is, I think the reason I get impatient isn't just because I haven't eaten, because I have a spirit of impatience. Mm. And the Lord's trying to bring that to the surface. And the Spirit's kind of saying like, hey, this is beneath this. And when all of a sudden you just take away something like food for a few hours, this comes out, maybe that's a problem. Maybe that's a symptom of a larger thing. And so I would want to just gently ask that person, like, maybe some of the reason it's really hard or you don't want to do it is because you're picking a fight with your flesh and you're losing the fight, you know, in some ways. And so how do we kind of do that? And I think that's also the importance of community, is community can help us determine and discern what maybe the Lord's doing in that season.
Think that once the undercurrents mm-hmm. that fasting exposes are seen, you also start to notice them when you're not fasting anymore, because they still come to the surface. They're a lot more subtle.
Yeah.
But now you've seen them.
Yeah.
Amplified. It's easier to identify the smaller peaks.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Which can be either encouraging or discouraging, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah. I think it's encouraging in the sense of at least now you have something to be aware of. Mm. You know, like I'd rather someone tell me my shadow side than it remain a shadow side. Mm-hmm. You know, because at least then I can attempt to bring that before the Lord and do something with it. But no doubt it's hard. I mean, no doubt it's hard. But again, I think that's, I mean, when Jesus talks, I think I ended the sermon with this. When you're to take up your cross daily and follow him, and crucify the flesh, that's not simple language. It's not easy language, but yet that leads to life and life to the fullest. That's what Jesus is inviting us on a path on, because none of us want to be, you know, Paul, when he sets up the distinction between the acts of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit, none of us want our lives defined by the acts of the flesh. Nobody at the end of their lives thinks, man, I wish people knew how envious I was. Like, no one actually wants that. And so this is really, in some ways, whatever renewing the mind looks like, right? Again, this is just two ways that we're saying this can help us in this path. Whatever it is, as believers, we want to walk by the Spirit, because ultimately that's the life that Jesus has on offer for us. And it's the life that I think our hearts most desire. But we've got to find a way to do that. And that tends to be a lot harder than we want to. Simple, but harder to actually do in practice.
But you know, it's so much easier, or I don't know, but easier is the right word, but I'm just imagining right now, if all of us decided, you know what, let's learn a language and none of us know it. That's a hard thing. It's going to be really hard if you go do that on your own, but it's going to be different if like the four of us are like, let's do it. Let's all take a class, form a study group. Let's do it together. There's like there's a camaraderie. There's a helping thing that happens. There's so much.
An empathy.
Yeah. There's so much that it just makes it easier. There's a reason doing this in community. So like I say that to say, if you're one of those people that's like, I don't know, try it with us.
Yeah.
Just try it with us. Let's all try it together and let's get hangry together. And you know, here come the roundhouse kicks.
Yeah. That should be our subtitle for this. Let's get hangry. Ha 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 ha.